It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to a graphic artist who's got some advice on creating appealing visual designs and appreciating design in the world around us.
First, Wisconsin is now one step closer to a higher speed limit. A bill that would increase the state speed limit to 70 miles per hour in some areas cleared the Assembly Transportation Committee and now goes to the full Assembly for a vote.
And our next guest is in favor of that change. We're joined now by John Bowman, Communications Director for the National Motorists Association. John, welcome to Central Time.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So why raise the speed limit to 70 miles an hour here in Wisconsin?
Well, there are several reasons why you would want to do that. First of all, if you look at what surrounding states are doing here in the Midwest, virtually all of Wisconsin's neighbors have either raised up their speed limits to 70 miles per hour or are in the process of doing it. And if you actually go back and look at the highway fatality rates in those states, you'll find that they're actually lower than they are here in Wisconsin. So there is, believe it or not, there is a safety benefit to raising speeds up to their safe and appropriate levels. And so that's what Wisconsin would be doing here. So there's definitely a safety benefit to it, as well as some other convenience and efficiency benefits associated with raising the speed up.
Is Wisconsin comparable in terms of the way that its roadways are structured? I'm just thinking, you know, Minnesota is sort of a plain state. There's a lot of ground to cover. Illinois is flat. Is Wisconsin similar?
In terms of how its interstates and major freeways are structured and engineered, it certainly is. If you go back to when the interstates were built, 40, 50 years ago, you'll find that throughout the country they were, in fact, engineered and built to tolerate speeds of 70 to 75 miles per hour. So, in fact, they've probably gotten safer since then. Certainly, vehicle technology and design has improved. So, really, the roads can handle it throughout the country, and certainly the vehicles can as well.
Now, we covered this topic before, this proposal, when we first heard about it here on Central Time. And judging by the feedback we got on the Facebook page, some callers, the number one concern people have is safety. Now, if we raise the speed limit, are we sacrificing safety for convenience?
Actually, if you look at studies and you look at what happens in the real world when speed limits go up like this, you actually find that it reduces accidents. And the reason for that is that when you raise speed limits up to their safe and appropriate levels based on traffic engineering standards, what you're doing is you're decreasing the speed variability among vehicles on the road, which is the cause for most vehicle conflicts and accidents. So for many years, we have had highway speeds that have been sort of artificially depressed. And now when we're getting them back up to where they should have been set all along, we're actually in the process of increasing highway safety. It sounds a little counterintuitive, but if you look at what happens in other states, for example, in Utah a few years ago, they raised a stretch of interstate up to 80 miles an hour from 75 miles per hour, and people had safety concerns. What happened, in fact, was really nothing. The speeds that people actually drove on that highway didn't change, and there was no increase in accidents or in fatalities. So it really does have a safety benefit when you do it the right way.
What about the concern that, you know, right now the speed limit's 65, and so therefore people usually, you know, drive 75, and if you make it 70, people will drive 80, 85?
Mm-hmm.
Or do people regulate themselves?
Yeah, people do regulate themselves, and that's really a good way to look at it. Again, when they've done studies and when they look at the speeds that people actually travel on the highways, they find that people reach a limit that is both safe and comfortable for them, no matter what the posted speed is. So people's travel speeds tend to be independent of the actual posted speed. So on a highway, let's say like I-94 between Milwaukee and Madison, you could raise the speed limit up to 85 or 90, not that you ever would, and you wouldn't find that people's travel speeds would really change all that much simply because they wouldn't feel safe going those higher speeds.
Now, there was a Democratic representative who suggested amending the bill to include stiffer penalties for things like distracted driving and not wearing a seatbelt. If the speed limit goes up, should these penalties go up, too?
Well, we've reviewed that. We've also reviewed the original bill, of course, and our organization supports the intent of the original bill. We'd like a little bit more time to kind of go through the amendments. They just came out in the last day or two. Our preference would be to sort of keep those issues separate from the speed limit bill. Quite frankly, there are already in place penalties for inattentive driving and for seatbelt violations. So we would probably just want to let those stand as they are.
Now, you mentioned efficiency and said this would be more efficient if the speed limit was raised. How exactly would that work, and wouldn't we be using more gas?
Well, again, what you have to keep in mind is that people are already going those speeds. If you've ever driven on the interstate, you know, between, again, here and Milwaukee or Madison and Twin Cities or whatever, you find that people are already going those speeds. So you wouldn't expect to see much of an increase, in actual travel speeds. What you would see, though, is by getting speed limits posted appropriately, is that you would see more of the slower drivers on the road actually increasing their speeds to match that of traffic around them. And in so doing, you're increasing traffic flow, you're decreasing bottlenecks, you're decreasing conflicts between and among vehicles. So you are actually increasing highway efficiency and in some regards helping with fuel usage, because you're decreasing the amount of stopping and starting, fast accelerations, quick lane changes. All of those contribute to fuel usage.
Now, I want to go back to the safety question for a moment. And you said that from what we've seen in other states, it hasn't resulted in highways that are less safe. But what about drunken driving? Now, if we raise the speed limit and we have someone who's driving drunk, doesn't that mean that, you know, just simple physics and impact is harder when you're going faster? More people would die.
Well, simple physics is always in play. And certainly vehicles traveling at higher rates of speed do have a greater impact when they strike other vehicles. Overall, though, when you set the speed limits correctly, you actually reduce the number of vehicle conflicts and therefore reduce the total number of accidents on the road. So it does have a preventative effect. Again, it sounds a little counterintuitive, but if you can reduce the overall number of accidents on highways, I would say that is the primary safety benefit. And when they do this in other states, that's what happens. So we see it as a safety benefit.
But would those accidents that did happen, would they be more likely to have fatalities?
It is possible. If you're already going at that speed, like I say, most people aren't going to change their driving habits very much because of this. And I'm not really sure that someone who is driving impaired on the highway is going to be paying a whole lot of attention to the speed limit anyways. I think studies have shown that that's not necessarily the case. So I don't think you're going to see much difference in the overall accident rates. If anything, they're going to improve.
So, John, if this bill becomes law, do you have an idea of how soon the change is going to take effect?
I don't know the details on that. I would imagine that the Wisconsin DOT, as well as the legislative people looking at this, would have a better sense of that. That could even be kind of up in the air right now, since the bill has not passed the full House. And from there, it would need to go through the whole Senate process, probably being reviewed in at least one committee, if not two or more. So changes could take place between now and when the bill is eventually passed into law.
All right. Well, John, thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We've been talking to John Bowman, the communications director for the National Motorists Association.
Coming up next, we'll talk with a rock star of graphic art about appreciating design in the world around us.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
Our next guest has been called a rock star of graphic design, among other things. He's created about a zillion book covers, and now he's sharing some advice on creating visual design and appreciating design in the world around us.
Chip Kidd is with us. He's an author, a designer. His new book is Go, A Kid's Guide to Graphic Design. Chip, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, reading your book, I realized there's something dangerous about thinking about design, because you just start to see it everywhere, and it is everywhere, isn't it?
Yes, and I don't think there's any danger in that.
So where do we, I mean, anything you write that isn't natural, it was designed by someone. That's a different way to think about the world that we don't pay attention to that much.
Well, I think, you know, I think it helps to pay attention to it. I mean, you have to consider that somebody has to figure everything out, and there's no reason to take that for granted. And when sometimes when people don't think figure things out very well, it can be rather catastrophic.
Now, even if we're not pros and we don't do this for a living, is it useful for us to think about design and work it into our lives?
I definitely think so. And I mean, everybody designs their life, whether they realize it or not, from what they wear to how they interact with coworkers or their friends or their family. I mean, that is design. And I know I'm getting a little egg-heady here. The book itself is really more about getting kids or any other kind of novice to graphic design to sort of think about what it is and what makes it up and what the components are, and then think about how to make it for themselves.
Well, let's get into that. I mean, I'm a novice, not a kid. There are a lot of kids who do better graphic design than I do. What are some of the basic tools if we're designing, I don't know, a PTA flyer or a sign or a logo or a for sale sign? What are some good tools we can use to make it pop a little more than we might on our first try?
Well, I think one thing you have to think about is clarity, actually. And you're saying a PTA flyer. What you know, hierarchies of importance, of information. What do you want your audience to see first when they see this PTA flyer? Do they want to see what day and time it is first? Do they want to see where it's being held first? You know, I think these are kinds of considerations to make when you're, you know, and that's a very sort of pragmatic piece of design. There's a sort of example I have in the book of about, you know, how do you design something to help somebody get out of a building right away if they need to, which is of course an exit sign. And the point being, you don't need something like that to be extremely elaborate or decorative or even, you know, extravagantly colored. What you need for it to be is very immediate and very recognizable and very understandable about where and how to leave a building. So something like a PTA flyer would be similar to that. Whereas there's no reason to make something like that overly decorative. You just need to be able to get your message out in the clearest, most concise way possible.
Do you think that's a stumbling block for some people? They try to make something that's really very functional and try to make it too ornate or pretty or complicated?
Well, you know, you'd have to take it as a case-by-case basis, but I certainly see examples of that all the time. I don't know if you do, but I'm sure that happens all the time.
Well, let's get into some of the tools. A lot of your book, as you mentioned, is a lot of different tips on things to try in graphic design. One of them you talk about is scale, big versus small. How do you use that contrast to best advantage?
Well, again, it all depends on what the problem is, and defining the problem helps you to more easily define the solution. And again, scale and big and small are all relative things. So what you start with is what you call your picture plane, which is, let's say it's a 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, and I'm just thinking out loud here. You've lost your cat, and you want to get him back desperately. So you would want to make the picture of the cat as relatively large as you can, so that people can more easily recognize him. And that's just common sense. But then, if you're going to put little tabs at the bottom so that people can call you, those are going to be relatively small because you're going to have a lot of them, and you're going to rip one of them off to use the phone number. So, I mean, there's just a kind of very pragmatic example of comparing large and small on the same page. But again, we're only talking about 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. If you have a lot of money and you're totally desperate, you can rent a billboard, and then that's something else entirely.
You really want that cat?
Yep.
So you've done a lot, over 1,000, I think we actually said zillions, we rounded up a little, of book designs. Talk us through your process. Like, how do you take a book and then figure out what the cover needs to look like?
You read it. You read the manuscript. And you just kind of take it from there, and you let the author basically guide you. But again, like I did a talk on for TED about this, and I don't want to overlap with that, because anybody can go online and see that, where I talk a lot about this in terms of specifically designing book covers. But you act as a translator. You act as an interpreter and a translator of the author's text into a visual icon.
All right. Well, let's go deeper into the toolkit now. You also write about using light and dark contrast. What are some tricks of the trade? And it doesn't matter if it's a particular, you know, sign or anything like that, but what are some of the ways we can use light and dark in our design?
Well, I mean, if you're dealing with typographic information, do you want to use a dark background with light type, or do you want to use a light background with dark type? If you're dealing with text on the written page, as you probably know, you want a white or off-white page, and you want dark type for because if you print an entire book the other way around, it's just going to strain your eyes. It's just not going to be good for you. Conversely, if you're driving down the highway and you're trying to find which way to go, there's a reason that highway signage has a relatively dark background and light letters, which, of course, are also very reflective for evening. And that's because you're only concentrating on a very small but very important amount of information. And in that case, a dark background with a light type works better. You know, also similarly, think of movie credits.
Oh, yeah. They're almost always light on dark.
It's always light on dark. But you wouldn't want to read a novel that way.
True. Very true. Well, I'm looking in your book right now. Positive and negative space. You use the FedEx logo as a successful use of negative space with that arrow hidden in amongst the letters.
Yes. Brilliant.
Why does that pop like it does?
Well, what's kind of wonderful about that is that it's there if you see it, but if you don't see it, it doesn't really matter. But it's just kind of a wonderful sort of subconscious, subliminal thing of, you know, not only is it an arrow, it's an arrow going from left to right. So where the E of FedEx meets the X of FedEx, the negative space makes an arrow that implies that they are going to be taking your package and successfully getting it from point A to point B. Another, I think, wonderful use of negative space that I cite earlier in the book in the history of graphic design is the a logo for Obama, the way inside it, the sun is rising over the horizon.
Right. Some people have said we're entering an age where images are becoming like a language. With that in mind, any advice on getting the most out of an image we use to send a message?
Well, first of all, I don't think that's changed. You know, the first graphic design was the cave paintings at Lascaux in 15,000 BC, and those were purely pictures. So in that sense, this is kind of old news. I'm not quite sure what the question is, but if you do a lot of traveling, especially to foreign countries that don't speak English, you'll see increasingly the signage is all in pictograms, so that no matter where you're from, you're able to read it. I think that's a good thing.
All right, in our last 30 seconds or so, Chip, you end with homework assignments. What's something that somebody could try right now to see to get into graphic design?
Oh, my goodness. Homework. That just sounds like no fun at all. I love the assignment of, you know, create a poster that either gets somebody to start doing something or stop doing something. I'm sure there's something in your life that you want started or you want stopped, and think about using graphic design to make that happen.
All right. And Chip, you're on your way to Wisconsin next week for the Library Association meeting, right?
That is correct. Now, to be more exact, that's October 22. So that's not next week.
Week after.
It's the week after. It's the 23rd, actually,
gotcha.
Wednesday. Green Bay.
All right, Chip, thanks a lot for joining us.
Okay. Quickly, can I give you the correct pronunciation of the book?
Go, A Kid's Guide to Graphic Design?
It's go,
gotcha.
A Kid's Guide to Graphic Design.
All right, Chip, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Chip Kidd, author and designer. His new book is Go, A Kid's Guide to Graphic Design.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll help you get ready for Halloween with a look at the greatest horror movies of all time, and you can share some of your favorites.
It's corn maze season. We'll find out what goes into designing a fiendishly difficult field trip.
And the author of Fight Club joins us as well. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. 5 years after devastating floods washed through the small town of Gays Mills, the community continues to come together to celebrate its unique apple ceremony and culture.
Producer Tegan Wendland attended the town's 55th annual Apple Festival to see what's changed and what remains the same.
In some ways, the Gays Mills Apple Festival is much like traditional festivals in other small Midwestern towns. There are carnival rides, flea markets, greasy foods, arts and crafts, and, of course, a parade. People come from out of town to visit the orchards and eat apples.
We have some samples of our jams and jellies here. Would you like to try one?
Please.
Which one would you like to try?
I'll try the jelly.
That's our apple jelly. It's made from apples from our farm.
Hmm. Good.
They're grown organically.
Oh, wow. That's good.
Thank you.
Oh, that's really good.
Charlie Prusser stands in a grassy lot on Main Street while a band plays at a nearby bar after the parade and children scream on the fair rides. As editor of the Crawford Independent and Kickapoo Scout, he's seen the town go through a lot of changes in the 20-some years he's lived here.
It is a typical small-town celebration, but it might be called a typical small-town celebration on steroids. You saw the parade. Everyone's in the parade. Every high school in a long ways brings their band to the parade, so it's a big deal.
Steve Downing of Decorah, Iowa, has visited the area regularly for the past few years.
Yeah, I like the area. You know, I like riding my motorcycle in the hills, and I have a classic car that I ride, drive, and we enjoy coming over here on the Wisconsin blacktop roads.
But Prusser says the floods have had a long-term impact on the town and tourism in the area.
We're almost standing on top of my office. Literally, my desk was on the other side of that tree, right there. We have two towns now. We have a town that's been constructed essentially in the last year and a half, and it's about a mile down the road from where we're standing. So you have these gaps.
Downing says he didn't even know that many of the businesses moved to the other side of town.
A year ago we drove by out there, and it looks like they've moved the town kind of, I don't know if that'd be east of here and north of here a little bit. It's kind of divided the place.
But up on a nearby ridge, apple grower Greg Welsh says little has changed. It's been a good year for apples at his orchard, Turkey Ridge Organics, and he's happy to wrap up the weeks of work he and his employees did in preparation for the festival.
The Apple Festival is just a good example of the resiliency of these small communities, how they can bounce back from whatever comes their way. And the flood was devastating for people, and yet the Apple Fest parade and the Apple Fest celebration is just as good as it ever has been. And so people just bounce back real quickly.
Visitors stream into his little shop to taste apple turnovers and buy bags of apples or pick their own. Local stable owner John Fritz gives them a tour of the orchards on a horse-drawn wagon.
Oh, Stan. Couldn't ask for a prettier day. It's starting a fall, and it's just a fun thing to do. These on this trees right here are called, they're called Liberties, and they taste a lot like a court apple, if you ever had those.
Welsh reaches up and picks one.
It's definitely organic.
How can you tell that?
Because there's a bug hole in it.
That story was produced by Tegan Wendland.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. You can find more information at wisconsinlife.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up after 4, we'll take a look at the showdown over the debt ceiling and find out what's at stake in the political tennis match.
First, if today's felt like a long day to you, our next guest can help put it in perspective. He's thinking about timescales in the millions and even billions of years. And today he'll take us on a tour on some key moments in pre-human history.
Neil Shubin joins us now. He's an evolutionary biologist, a fossil hunter, and associate dean of biological sciences at the University of Chicago. His newest book is called The Universe Within, the Deep History of the Human Body. Neil, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So as a scientist, you routinely think about time in terms of timescales, millions and billions of years. How does it change how you might think about the significance of, say, a human life?
Yeah, it really does change your perspective of the present. I mean, I spend my summers cracking into rocks and thinking of fossils over 300, 375 million years old. And every now and then, you know, the fact of that catches up with me. I say, oh my gosh, you know, you think in the order of millions, if not hundreds of millions or billions of years. What you start to see is the universe and our planet as incredibly vast and incredibly ancient, and that we, our species, we as individuals, you know, are part of this just giant landscape that has, you know, existed long before us and will exist long after us. So you could say, in a sense, that makes you feel really small. but in reality, and this is the theme of the book, was quite the opposite, that the more we look, the more we find that science teaches us not this, that, you know, we're this tiny little speck in the history of the universe, but that we're deeply connected to it, that our molecules, our atoms, the structures of our very bodies are linked to the planet, the solar system, and the universe beyond.
So now, that's something, that's, you know, you hear that from time to time, that we are stardust. We are made of stardust. And I never know, you know, how literally to take that. Are we stardust?
Yeah, take it really literally. Because when you think of the atoms in our bodies, you know, the oxygen, the carbon, you know, the fundamental building blocks that make compose our matter, those were born in the nuclear engines inside of stars. And so the process of stellar evolution, of these nuclear reactions evolving over time as stars go through their lives, gave birth in different ways to the different sized atoms in our body. And so when you think about our deepest connection to the universe, it really lies in those, you know, the smallest bits of us, the tiny atoms. So the atoms in the rock you hold and the atoms inside your body are linked in a history, and not only in the history of the planet, but of the stellar, you know, the star forming processes that existed well before our planet ever came into being.
So break that down a little bit more for us. I mean, how did these same atoms that were part of a supernova become part of our bodies?
Yeah, well, what, you know, you think about, you know, the layers after layers of history that exist in bodies and rocks and planets and so forth. Inside of each star, you know, at the core of each star are nuclear reactions that are ongoing, that are producing enormous amounts of energy. Now, the byproduct of those nuclear reactions are combinations of atomic nuclei that are ever larger. And so the oxygen, the carbon, and so forth that are inside of us were not only, you know, created inside of stars, but they were spread about through the universe in the processes of the explosion of supernovae and so forth. Now, our planet itself, the best evidence we have for the age of the Earth is about 4.57 billion years old. And it accreted from matter and space that itself was forming as our solar system formed. Our solar system formed as a giant disk with the sun converging in the center and the planets forming in successive layers out in this disk of matter. And it's from that matter, which was originally accreted, you know, in throughout the universe, you know, matter from all over the universe, that made our planet and our bodies. So the that is the most fundamental link. So as we unpack that, what we start to see is the links to the, you know, to the evolution of stars and the links to the formation of our solar system itself. But it goes much, you know, much more recent as well.
Well, how long ago did life emerge on Earth, and how hard is it to find that fossil evidence that you look for?
You bet. That's quite the mystery. So if you look at the first evidence of life, the first real sort of evidence of life are fossils, single-celled fossils, that existed around 3 billion years ago, a little more than 3 billion, actually. And they look very much, in some ways, like the kinds of blue-green algae or colonies of blue-green algae that are around on the planet today. So they would look generally familiar in some ways.
But what's clear is life had to get going much before that, before you even had that organization. And so the great mystery is, you know, there's would be this whole history of life on our planet before they would ever, you know, have fossil evidence that would suggest it. So the evidence we have for pre-fossil life comes from the chemistry of the rocks. Because when you think about it, life has a chemical signature. You know, as we walk on the planet, as we breathe and eat and do our business as organisms, just like everything from blue-green algae to people, we leave a chemical signature on the planet. And that chemical signature can actually be seen in the balance of atoms inside of very ancient rocks. So it's thought, when you start to look at that chemistry, that it's thought that the metabolic processes associated with life began fairly early, might have began, you know, before 3.6 billion years ago. How did it begin? That's one of the great mysteries. And, you know, that's something which we don't have hard evidence for. All we have are theories that we can test in different ways.
Do you think we'll find that evidence, say, in your lifetime?
Yeah, that's a hope. I mean, the kind of evidence you probably see is somebody who sort of is able to copy the environment of the early Earth in a test tube. Say, okay, you have this matter, you have this amount of energy, and then run that experiment in a lab and create a replicating molecule. That is, to be able to copy the kinds of chemical environments that existed billions of years ago, and then to sort of simulate the formation of life by just what exists in that glass. I think that's possible because, you know, it's funny, the amazing thing is as you read the scientific literature, we're getting closer and closer to that. There were famous experiments done in the 50s, and actually at the University of Chicago, that showed if you mimicked the conditions of the early Earth and then hit it with an energy jolt, you can get the basic building blocks of DNA, of proteins, amino acids, and so forth. And most recently, it's been shown that you can get sort of prototypes of replicating molecules. So I think, yeah, it's not unreasonable to expect that an experiment like that in my lifetime may be successful. Boy, that would be so exciting.
Yes, you could get a baby universe, at least the building blocks in a test tube.
In a test tube,
build your own universe kits.
Right.
Well, right now we're talking with Neil Shubin, evolutionary biologist and the author of The Universe Within, The Deep History of the Human Body.
We'll continue the conversation coming up. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We pick up our conversation now with Neil Shubin. He's the author of The Universe Within. And Neil, this is a kind of a sweeping book you've written here, and you take some looks at little known areas of history as we look at the scope of human life and the fossil record. And one of the people you call attention to is someone probably a lot of us haven't heard of, Henrietta Leavitt.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. I mean, that was, for me, that discovery of Henrietta Leavitt's story was such a memorable moment because I was, you know, writing the chapter about the Big Bang, and I was thinking, you know, how did we learn of the Big Bang? And what I was discovering as I was writing the book, not just for the Big Bang, but for other topics, was many unheralded scientists, many of them often women, who made major discoveries that changed the way we think about the universe or the planet. And Leavitt was one of those. I mean, she was one of the people known as the Harvard computers. Edward Charles Pickering, when he was working at Harvard, was collecting a lot of data, and he was really angry at the men who were working in his lab. He thought he was overpaying them. So he made a joke one day that he could hire his maid at half the cost of these guys. And he fell in love with the idea and ended up firing all the guys and hiring his maid, Wilhelmina Fenn Fleming, to work in the lab to crunch his data. And she hired this woman, Henrietta Leavitt. And Leavitt had the great privilege and the great smarts of sitting with the raw data of the universe that was coming at the time, pictures from telescopes. And she was focusing on a particular kind of star called a variable star. And there's particular different kinds. She was focusing on one class of them. And she discovered something truly fundamental. She discovered that you can calculate from knowing how fast these variable stars went from bright to dim, you can calculate the real brightness of the star, which was a huge advance. There's a lot of physics behind it. She was a very good mathematician. And with that insight, she provided the first major ruler to understand the distances in deep space. That is, a ruler to measure how far stars or galaxies are to our planet. And it was a game changer. It truly was. It set the stage for so much discovery that happened. And I remember reading about Henrietta Leavitt, and I just stared at her picture for, you know, about 45 minutes afterwards. And just, it was just a remarkable moment for me, and I wanted to capture it in a brief way, but I wanted to do justice to her and the women who were the Harvey computers, because it was just such a, you know, again, a game changer for how we viewed the universe, but also how we view our place in the universe. Because with Leavitt's ruler, the universe became incredibly vast, you know, beyond our wildest imagination, you know? And it really changed our not only our view of the universe, but our view of ourselves in the universe. So just one of those, you know, beautiful stories.
Yeah, that's amazing. So she was a maid, and he trained her in physics, her employer?
Well, so Leavitt went to Wellesley College. She was a good mathematician. So Wilhelmina Fleming was his maid, and she formed the connections to recruit this group of very, very intelligent women. And it's fair to say that Leavitt, had she lived long enough, would have won the Nobel Prize. I mean, so that's certainly Nobel Prize level stuff, you know. And this was, 1914 or so? It's just one of these stories that I think needed to be told. And it holds a very special place in that chapter because she was a special person and the discovery was very special. But there were others as well, you know, Maria Tharp and the study of the Earth and others. It was just, for me, this discovery was part of the fun of writing the book.
And it also illustrates, you know, how we are sort of feeling our way to a complete picture of the universe and all the different people and the way they've contributed the evidence, and we're getting a sharper and sharper image as we go along.
You bet. I mean, that's one of the things, is that science is a very human enterprise, right? We have the scientific method and the scientific process, which is a pretty scripted set of rules. You know, that there is a right and a wrong. There is a way to test scientific theories. But the way of getting there is often really human. You know, I know very personally from my own work, you know, we try, we fail, we succeed, we get lucky. Sometimes we're smart, most of the times we're not. I mean, it's just one of those things. We are fumbling around. I mean, Carl Sagan described, you know, science as a candle in the dark. You know, you see only so far. But hopefully as our tools get better, as we build on the work of others, we start to see the universe, our bodies and other things in new light.
Now, you've done a lot of conceptualizing about Earth millions of years ago. Do you think if we were to see Earth in a picture, or could drop in and have a little time travel visit, say 500 million years ago, would we recognize it?
Probably not. It wouldn't be very familiar. The first thing is, if you were, you know, first we need a spacesuit just to survive. I mean, the atmosphere would be very different. The levels of oxygen would be very different. You wouldn't recognize it. Let's say you transport back to 500 million years ago. There would have been no life on land, okay? No trees, no bushes, no shrubs, no creatures walking about. I mean, all life was in the seas. Land was a rocky place. And if you go to the oceans 500 million years ago, you would have seen life. It would have been some of the earliest creatures with bodies swimming around. You would have recognized some of those. Some of those would have been outrageously strange. But there wouldn't have been anything you'd recognize as a fish swimming around. But it would feel like an alien world. And then when you... And that's one of the things that your opening question was about deep time. You know, how does that affect you? But also when you think about how we reconstruct and know the world and what it looked like millions of years ago, it often reveals just how strange our present today is. You know, we look around the world. You know, we have a world with ice at the poles. We have a world configured in a certain way with continents in particular places, with life looking a certain way. But that's pretty unique. You know, you go back in time, most of the history of the Earth didn't have ice at the poles. You know, most of the history of the Earth didn't have the continents and the positions they are today. You know, so you begin to see that our present moment is just one snapshot of an incredible, you know, story, you know, that goes back, you know, billions of years. It gives you a new perspective on the present in many ways.
And looking at these grand timescapes like you have, do you have a sense of which way the arrow of evolution is moving right now?
Yeah, that's the hardest thing to say because, you know, if you look at humanity and who we are and what we're able to do, the major change that we have is we now have inventions, tools. We make gizmos that extend our senses into space, into the deepest portions of the ocean. You know, for a long time, our senses were just, you know, the area around us. But now our senses are machines that we devise that go out, you know, beyond the reaches of the solar system, you know, as Voyager just did, to the bottom of the ocean, as James Cameron did 2 years ago. And those devices of our design are really changing our view of the planet, but they're changing our future. Because if you think about, you know, what humanity is likely to look like in 500 years, let's take your question. Instead of going back in time, let's go forward. You know, let's go forward to 5,000 years in the future or a million years in the future. You know, what will humanity look like? You know, it's hard to discount our technologies, right? Our machines, our medications, our ideas and inventions, which will change our bodies and our performance and the ways we interact with the planet. I mean, it's all pretty deep stuff, but when you think about it, you know, we humans now have the power through our ideas and the devices we use and make to change the our performance. You know, just look at bicycling, you know, Lance Armstrong. But take it more serious. You can brain function. Our performance in many ways are likely to be affected by our technologies. So it's safe to say that if looking forward to the future, it's not just Charles Darwin that's behind, you know, the driving wheel of our future, but it's really our own inventions and our social and economic structures that give people access to those inventions.
Now, this is not something that you write about in your book, but I'm curious, you know, we've talked about recently whether or not human consciousness could be downloadable into our devices, say into a computer. And I guess from your perspective as a scientist and someone who kind of lives in this deep time zone, would you want to do that so you could see what comes next?
No. Yeah, actually, no. I'm a creature of my time. I'm a creature of my place. I wouldn't be Neil Shubin if you were to, you know, suck me in the machine and transport me some at some other time. I'm in the here and now with the people who I interact with and love and talk to, with my environment. You know, it's that's who I am. It's that continual feedback between me, my genetics of who I am, just like all of us, and our environment. And, you know, disrupt that equation, it would no longer be me. So that's kind of why I'm here now, even though mentally I'm deep in the past.
So do you think that doing what you do live with more wonder than, say, the rest of us pedestrians who don't look up at the stars every day like you do?
Well, every now and then I have to pinch myself, to be quite honest. You know, when I'm cracking rocks or looking at the stars, you know, most of the time I'm just looking at lights or correcting a bone in a rock. And then, but, you know, every now and then, you know, I stop. And I do have that sense of wonder. And it's those moments I try to bottle for when I am sitting in front of a computer writing a book. Because it's those moments I need to recapture, because that's kind of what I want to convey. You know, that's what I feel I can do, bring to people who can't join me on expeditions to the Arctic. But that's something I can convey, that sense of wonder that comes from it.
Oh, well, you're doing a great job of that today. Neil, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Thank you very much.
That was Neil Shubin, author of The Universe Within.
Coming up, the debt ceiling deadline keeps coming closer. We'll hear about the politics, policies, and possible consequences. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.